Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now, I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So I'm delighted to be joined today by Professor Tim Hubbard, who is the head of the Department of Medical and Molecular Genetics at King's College London, and a professor of bioinformatics. He is a senior advisor to Genomics England, among many other things that he does. And we're going to touch on some of the iconic programs that Tim has been involved in over the years, not least the Human Genome Project, and as has risen to fame recently with the Google DeepMind competition, the CASP program, Critical Assessment of Structure Prediction, which is where AlphaFold 2 outperformed the human competition so much. Tim, welcome to the pod.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's great to be here.
Now, take us back. Typically, people aren't born as professors of bioinformatics and heads of the Department of Medical and Molecular Genetics. When did you first get into this world?
So the genome world, I mean, I was actually a structural biologist before that. Kind of came from university where one of the lecturers talked about the protein folding problem and said he thought it was impossible. And that was kind of like a red rag to a bull. And that's where I chose my PhD in predicting protein structures. And in fact, slightly, I got diverted into protein design. But that's what I did for, you know, around 10 years.
And what were you studying at university in the first place? Sorry, just to take you even further back, like how did you get into...
Well, actually, yes, of course, I was I came in as a sort of card-carrying physical scientist, physics, maths, chemistry. I hadn't done any biology at school, really, since 13. In fact, if you scratch the surface, you'll find that I know no biological knowledge underneath at all, almost. But because the university...
We won't tell anyone, don't worry.
Because the university course kind of was broad in the first year and kind of forced you to do other subjects, I took... a biology course and discovered biology was digital because, you know, when I lasted at school, it sounded like it was all just looking at stuff under microscopes. So that interested me and it's kind of where it led to doing a PhD in proteins and the computation around that. And that was the time when bioinformatics really wasn't called bioinformatics. The closest thing was the biocomputing unit at EMB or Heidelberg, started by Chris Sander, and that's where the idea of protein design came from, actually, because the protein prediction problem had been going on so long that people had begun to think, you know, it was impossible. And Chris Sander said, well, maybe let's do the inverse protein folding problem. Let's do the protein design problem. Surely it's easier to design proteins than it is to predict their structure. And so that's what my PhD became.
Uh-huh. And so, Tim, give us the quick sort of biology 101. So we've talked about proteins, we've talked about genomes. Like, how are these things related?
So genomes encode, you know, the blueprint of any life form. It's the DNA sequence that's in every cell. And that DNA sequence specifies genes. And a lot of those, well, most of those genes encode a protein. And so you've got four letters of DNA encoding 20 letters of amino acids that make up a protein. So in fact, it's been known since the 60s, a conversion between that base 4 to base 20. So proteins, they end up getting synthesized in the cell from reading the DNA. And those proteins, they're linear sequences. But the clever thing is they fold up by themselves into three-dimensional shapes. And it's those shapes that give function. So it's very important to know the structure of proteins. Knowing the sequence, you know, that's what you get from a genome. It's useful, but it's not enough to understand what's really going on.
Got it. And when we talk about function, what kind of things do proteins then do?
Well, they are pretty much everything that goes on in a cell. They can be structural, they can be signaling cascades from the outside world, but a lot of them are enzymes that catalyze all the metabolism that goes on in a cell as well. So almost everything that goes on in a cell is driven by proteins. In humans, there's around 20,000, you know, major different types.
So a lot of complexity to wrap one's head around. And what sort of rough time period are we talking about when you were getting into this field of, as you put it, sort of computational biology? What did computers look like at this point?
Oh, you know, my first computer system at Birkbeck, where I was doing my PhD, was a PDP-11, which is ancient, massive machine with disk drives that those huge cartridges you sometimes see in ancient films that you take the lids off and unmount that. It had a 28K core memory.
Wow.
28 kilobytes. And then we had this brand new thing called a VAX 11750, which was a, you know, step up from Digital Equipment Corporation. I don't know, I can't remember how much memory it had, but, you know, it was the next stage up from that. And we had to display the proteins, because that was the big thing. You had these Evans and Sutherland picture systems. These were graphics computers. And computers in those days weren't good enough to display like we do now. Everything was vectors, so it just drew lines between atoms, and it was just the lines that you could rotate. There was no space filling whatsoever.
I'm getting flashbacks to the early computer games like Elite, which were all...
Yep, that's right. The kind of stuff. And you had to sit in a darkened room to do anything.
Just because the screens weren't bright enough, or how come?
Yes, that's right, yes.
Okay. And so what kind of questions were you asking and answering using these machines?
Well, I mean, it really was. I mean, the department was a crystallography department. This is PhD time, and people were solving structures using X-ray. So part of the problem of solving a structure, you crystallize the protein, having purified it. You then shine X-rays at it. You collect a whole load of data, and then you try and interpret that data. And that process at that time suddenly was very manual. It involved many, many hours, days, sitting in front of these screens, trying to interpret what electron density maps, which showed where they thought the atoms were, and you had to try and fit the chain to that. Now, I wasn't doing that. I was doing kind of the opposite. Can I design a sequence, or can I predict the structure of a sequence? But using the same sort of display tools for manipulating three-dimensional objects.
Got it. So the DNA gives us the blueprint. That then creates RNA, which in turn encodes proteins. And actually now we're saying that the protein structures. So X-ray crystallography is what Rosalind Franklin used to determine the structure of DNA back in the, whenever it was, 50s, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, if you want a structure of a molecule, you basically use X-ray crystallography, which means you've got to manage to find out a way to crystallize the damn whatever you're trying to deal with. And that's not a predictable thing. There are many, many stories of things that prove to be impossible to crystallize, to find. You end up modifying the molecules to try and get them to form crystals. But it's true for DNA. It's true for, of course, DNA has got a very regular structure because it's, you know, it's just a long, long sequence. Once we knew what the structure was, that applies to all DNA pretty much. Proteins, though, every sequence has a different structure. That's what makes them unique, and unique as a molecular tool in the cell to carry out different functions.
And so this is a very complex science problem, is can we predict the structure of these proteins? How does it relate to the kind of questions that either a doctor in a hospital or someone in a pharma company trying to make a drug or a vaccine, how does this help them to do those things?
So if you've got a structure, I mean, generally, when you're designing a drug or trying to get a drug, you're trying to block the action of a protein. That's in most cases. And it's a lock and key type of situation. Proteins are shaped so they can bind molecules. That's what why the shape is important. So if you're trying to design a drug, you're trying to build a molecule which will also bind to the protein and block whatever it's doing, or sometimes try and encourage what it's doing. That's drug development. And if you haven't got a structure, that's pretty difficult to do. You can use some techniques of just screening millions and millions of different molecules, but in the end, to optimize the molecules, you're much better off if you've got a three-dimensional structure. So structure is critical, really, to drug development. And, you know, many pharma companies have their own activities around trying to crystallize structures. But it's true for almost every kind of investigation that if you don't know what the function of a protein is, if you don't know what structure is, then it gets in the way of your research.
So can you give us an example of a drug or a therapeutic? Like, what kind of protein is it looking for, and how does structure play into that? Let's just see if we can bring it to life.
I mean, one of the classic ones is, you know, viruses. If you want to block something like, think of HIV. HIV's got a protein, makes a protein, which chops the molecule up into many pieces. They then all carry out different functions. And so one of the targets for drug development was, let's try and block this protease, this thing that chops up the large RNA, the large molecule that's made by the HIV virus into its different pieces, because if you can block that, then you can block the infection of HIV. So can you build a drug that will inhibit that protein? That's one strategy. Then there are other proteins that carry out other functions in that virus, which there are also attempts to build blocking molecules. In fact, the best strategy has turned out to be combination therapies, where you combine several different molecules which block different types of reactions in the virus. So that's an example of the types of drug development that goes on.
Got it. So in that instance, the drug is kind of rushing a protein and kind of jumping on top of it and smothering it and stopping it doing what it's doing. But that'll only work. You use the sort of key and lock analogy.
Yeah, I mean, think of a key where you filled it with blue tack so you can't fit the key in, for example, a lock. You know, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to block it so that the real thing that it's normally meant to do can't go on.
So the work that you were doing on this ever-evolving and ever more complex series of computers for predicting protein work, you mentioned that one of your early lecturers had suggested that this problem was impossible. How have we gone from impossible not so long ago to basically solved in 2020?
Well, it's been impossible for quite a long time. I mean, it's been known for 50 years. Back in 1994, which is kind of 10 years after we started trying this design idea, and in fact decided that design was actually even worse than protein folding, we should go back to protein folding. Friend of mine, John Malt, started this idea, which was to set up this competition, because half the problem was, how do you know if anybody solved the protein folding problem when the only things they're predicting are things they already know about? And X-ray crystallography is so slow that if you make a prediction about something that isn't known, well, you might wait for decades to find out if you got it right or not. So CASP became a structure for testing. Every year, every 2 years, there would be a set of targets where the structure was about to be solved, but wasn't public yet. And so there was a window for people to make predictions. And that's gone on now for 26 years. Every 2 years, there's this competition. And as more structures have been solved, it's been possible to end up with around 100 targets each time, each competition. So there's enough to have a sort of statistical view about who's making progress and which algorithms are the most useful. And there's been gradual progress in this, because, you know, there's a period of competition, there's a meeting, the best people get to present, and they have to present about what went right and what went wrong and how their methods worked. And that stimulates sort of, you know, a directional change maybe from the community who try and improve on those methods. So it's partly an evaluation and partly a community exercise in working together. And so there's been gradual progress for, what, 20 years? And then 4 years ago, DeepMind joined the competition and they applied AI methods, which were becoming, you know, more tractable in this field, I guess, around that time. And they did better than anybody 2 years ago. This time round, though, they haven't just done better. They've got a solution which is essentially, in almost all cases, indistinguishable from experiment, which is why we're saying, you know, they've essentially solved it.
And so, and without getting too nerdy on the AI, as far as I understand it, the first time, so 2 years ago, that DeepMind were competing, they were using basically a sort of massive deep learning model that was looking at all of the inputs, looking at all of the outputs, lots and lots of layers, and was pretty much a black box, but was just crunching the numbers. And then this time around, they actually tried to build in more of the kind of physics and the chemistry and the biology to actually narrow down the solution space. Is that right? Or just help us understand what changed from 2 years ago to this year.
2 years ago, I think they were doing what was, you know, they were using the networks to produce a rough structure. I mean, the networks were actually coming up with something like a contact map, saying which bits of the structure were near to each other. And because that had been one of the areas that had made more progress recently. And then once you've got that rough structure, then trying to refine it. So there's this sort of idea that, you know, proteins have a kind of complexity in terms of the way the chain folds in space, which gives you a rough idea of what it looks like. But then there's the detail of exactly how all the atoms fit together at high resolution. That's what you get from crystallography. Now, this refinement process using physical algorithms, simulations, also turns out to be very difficult. And it's hard to judge when you've got the right answer. What they did this time was to bring all those two things together. So they ended up with a single network that went all the way from the final 3D structure right back to the sequence. And so their training process included, you know, back propagation from the 3D sort of space all the way back to the contact space, back to the sequence space. So that's what they've managed to do. They've managed to combine into a single network the entire problem, rather than having it as a kind of like a two-stage process. And they've used this time something called attention, which is the sort of latest way of training neural networks, which I think, as you know, it's, you know, this is all very new. We've only heard about it in the last few weeks and the details aren't really out yet, but that's being seen by the community as one of the key things. Attention is where only certain parts contribute, and that fits better to, I think, the three-dimensional space aspect of this problem, where you've got things in the sequence which are far apart in the sequence but are close together in three dimensions.
And what happens from here? If we can, let's imagine for a second that we can mainstream this technology so it becomes both cheaper and a lot faster to accurately predict protein structures on the basis of the string of letters that makes up the structure of the, or the sequence of the amino acid. How does that play out in terms of research or in terms of other developments?
That's exactly where I think we are, that we've gone from, you've got a few structures. I mean, there's been a huge effort, for example, in human to get X-ray structures. And despite decades of effort and vast investments in, you know, synchrotrons and people around the world working on this, we only got to 17% of the sequence which we know makes up proteins in human. It should be possible to essentially feed all the sequence through this DeepMind machine and get the entire set. Once you've got the entire set, and I should say that each of these predictions comes with accuracy indications as well. And it does look like they're pretty accurate nearly all the time. So rather than previous predictions where you were always somewhat uncertain about whether even the rough fold was correct, this time around, I think they can be trusted. Once you've got this trusted full set, you can start thinking about how can I fit them together in the machinery of the cell? Because, you know, that's where we kind of should have gone from a whole genome. You have a whole genome, you've got all the genes potentially, you should be able to build up everything in the cell and almost, you know, start from, you know, existence to the derivation of the existence of income tax, as you know, in the Hitchhiker's Guide. You know, it really should be like that, you know, but with, in many ways, the way I look at it as being, we could sequence the genome, but yes, the genome was encrypted because we couldn't do this step of getting from protein sequence to protein structure. That was, you know, we saw these strings, but we didn't know what they did. And having AlphaFold is like having a Rosetta Stone, being able to do all that translation. You couldn't read the language before. And if you want to understand how a genome functions, and from the point of view of Genomics England, how every mutation affects how a genome might function in an individual, you need to apply that to a complete mechanistic machine of how the cell works. So you can see this variation actually interact, it affects maybe this protein folding, or maybe it affects two proteins interacting, and be able to model all of those processes.
Got it. So from a human system point of view, we can say, right, we've understood for a while now what DNA is and how it works, and then getting to RNA and encoding amino acids, and then there's this fundamental, what has previously been a pretty mysterious process of how we go from that to these three-dimensional proteins that then make all of these things happen in the body. They're going to regulate our hormones, that will translate into the way that our organs operate, the way that we develop when we're embryos in the womb, the way that we age. And we're saying, actually, making that step in the chain less mysterious, making it known, means that we can make better predictions between what we can see in the DNA and what we can see in the human being who either walks into a hospital or you know, is thinking about their health and their wellness.
Exactly. And that's towards personalized medicine. Now, of course, human is, you know, any organism is fantastically complicated. 37 trillion cells in a human. We don't even know how many different cell types there are. That's the limits of our level of understanding. But, you know, there's a place to build from now. I mean, we can't even work out exactly where the genes are. The only way we can do that currently is by collecting external data, actually get those RNA transcripts by collecting them and sequencing and then going and mapping them back to the DNA. That's not a perfect process. And the reason we do that is because we can't model the actual creation of that RNA, because that creation of all that RNA involves a lot of proteins and we didn't have all the structures. But now we could think about building that entire machinery from all these proteins and working out how they fit together and having a better set of genes and building up all of those layers from there.
Got it. And it feels like we're gradually working our way up from, as you say, the sort of the blueprint, the encrypted blueprint of the DNA to the RNA to the protein to the cell. And we're saying there are still bits of how cells work that remain mysterious. And then actually it's those cells that really make up our body and make up, you know, our liver or our lungs or whatever, right? What are the question, if we imagine that protein folding is now, you know, solved, you know, it seems like it's getting close to be, what are the next set of questions around cells that will help us understand this incredibly complex system, the human, better?
So within cells, there are a lot of machines made up of lots and lots of proteins. I mean, complicated things, you know, just the business, as I said, of making, transcribing the genes alone, but a whole load of other bits of machinery inside that cells. I mean, cells are not a uniform body. They contain lots of organelles, for example, you know, subdivisions of cells which carry out particular functions. So it's quite a long way to go just to understanding how individual cells work, let alone how cells work together to make organs and work together then to make whole system. So we've got quite a long way to go. But I really think that we've got through a barrier, which when you combine it with all the other data, will allow us to make quite a lot of progress quite fast.
It's exciting times. And if we lift our heads and think forward, let's say 25 years into the future, you know, it was Yogi Berra who said, "We never make predictions, especially about the future." But let me ask you to do that. Where do you think we could be in 25 years in terms of this research, and what would that mean to the proverbial man or woman on the Clapham omnibus?
Well, you know, with UK, with Genomics England and the Genome Medicine Service, we're already mapping out to sequencing, you know, 1 million genomes in the next 5 years. The population is, only 60 million. There's no point in sequencing everybody right now because we don't understand enough about the genome to make that clinically useful. But I think that will change over time. As long as you can show that having somebody's genome starts to have some clinical benefit on average through their lifetime, it'll be worth sequencing for healthcare. And the more data we have, the more, when we combine that with medical records, the better our understanding will get. And, you know, I really do think there's going to be a bump in understanding and interpretation from having all these protein structures. So, you know, there was a plan for a European project called Digital Twins a number of years ago. Can you build a digital version of yourself alongside that you use to diagnose what's the best drug for you, what's the best therapy in the future? This puts us more towards that personalized medicine direction. It's just a question of having enough understanding.
Right. Very cool. And so that concept of the digital twin started with things like jet engines, right? That you would set off a model of the jet engine when it first went into production, and when it got maintained, you could update that. Jet engines are admirably complex bits of machinery, but I guess compared to the complexity and, I don't know if messiness is the right word, of the human body, creating a digital twin of a human feels like a multiple orders of magnitude more complex process. How would that work?
Yes, I mean, that's the critical thing is, it's true, we've got much, much better at, you know, planes, you know, monitored as they're flying, and, you know, there's a diagnosis of what maintenance needs to be done at every airport when they arrive. But every engine is designed to be identical, and that's not the same for us. We're all different. We all have 4 million variants compared with any other person. And so we firstly need a model of, you know, kind of the average human, and then layer on top of that all of those variants so that we see how this individual, for this individual's digital twin, is subtly different from any other human. And so the inputs that affect one person won't affect another person in the same way. So that's a much more complicated level of modeling that's going to have to be done in order to make that useful. And we're just at the start of that with rare diseases and cancers right now. And you can see, of course, you know, we can improve our diagnosis of rare disease with whole genome sequencing, but there's a whole load, you know, more than half of those cases, we've got the whole genome and we still don't know what's wrong with that person. Well, why they're ill. So there's a lot more to be learnt in interpreting those variants. And again, with the proteins, I think you'll be able to map those variants against all those protein structures and be in a much better position to interpret what variant is causing an effect and why.
Got it. So answering that why question is an incredibly powerful element of what the protein folding helps us to do.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And in fact, your point about the average human being and kind of de-averaging that to get towards personalized medicine, I guess there's an analogy there almost to the world of e-commerce, right? That we used to think of someone coming in as a shopper, and then you start to slice and dice them in different ways and say, ah, this person is a rich shopper, and this person is a average shopper, this person is a not well-off shopper, this person is an old shopper or a young shopper or a male shopper or a female shopper, and so on. And you start to combine all of these slices and dices until you're getting smaller and smaller segments of people, and ultimately you get to the so-called segment of one, which, for example, you know, Amazon is famous on, you know, treating each shopper as an individual. Can you see us going down that path of gradually de-averaging and then zeroing in on the case of one in medicine as well? Can you see it following a similar trajectory?
In the sense that there's this combination of variants. So I think there's an example there of saying, you know, some you know, we know some variants that are pathogenic, that if you've got that variant, you're likely to get ill. But not everybody with that variant gets ill. So the question is, why is that? And that's to do with the background. Yes, it's a dangerous variant, but only in a subset of people, because it depends on what all the other layer of variants, you know, there's the other 4 million. And obviously some of those will interact with this key variant in a way maybe that compensates it and means that it's not as dangerous in that individual. And so that kind of background effect, modeling all the rest alongside something you know that actually has an important effect, that's the kind of, you know, N equals one that you're going to have to get to really be able to say, you know, I see this pattern of variations in you and it's going to have an effect on you. Of course, we mustn't forget environment in all this. You know, genetics is not, we're not, you know, completely determined by genetics. It's a combination of environment and genetics. But certainly there's lots more to be done in terms of interpretation than where we are right now.
Exciting times. And let me throw a different question at you, which is when we start to think about those kind of combinatorial explosion problems, like, okay, we understand that this variation in the genome, in the DNA, can often be associated with this condition or this illness or whatever, but actually there's stuff that could be happening across the other 21,000 genes or 3 billion base pairs of DNA that could counteract that effect or whatever. Often people talk about quantum computing being very suitable for solving these kind of combinatorial explosion problems. Like there's a famous kind of, can you optimize the wedding guests at a wedding party, which, you know, conventional computers would take billions of years to solve. Can you see quantum computing playing a role in answering some of these complex combinatorial questions about what's happening in our DNA and how that translates into the kind of functions through proteins?
Well, I think I'd probably go back to just AI, actually, because, you know, the business of protein folding, for a long time, we thought that it was a question of physical description, the interactions between atoms, and there was a subpart of the prediction world that was just trying to do this with big computers and simulations. And it was always, well, you know, we'll come back in several years' time when the computers are 10 times faster. And it never did. And somehow the AI world has kind of got round that problem and ended up with this, you know, I mean, it's this level of accuracy that we've got this time around, which is just amazing. And so somehow AI has learnt something about the physical interactions. You know, it's a combination of the chemistry and the entropy of the train that, you know, leads to particular combinations being favoured energetically. And we couldn't capture that effectively with physics. But AI has done it. So it does make you think, you know, one way of looking at this solution is, well, I've got all the whole set of proteins now. Now I can do some other stuff with those, with simulations or whatever. But it actually also makes you think, well, actually, if AI could do this, maybe it can do the next levels as well. So, you know, I think it's all time for us to all go and learn about the current advances of AI and to go and, well, you know, there's very big machines out there now for doing AI processing and use those. So it may, you know, quantum computing, well, it may be enough to just use the AI techniques.
And it's a mark of how far all of these fields are advancing and how rapidly that we can now talk about, oh, we can just use AI to solve that previously unsolved problem.
Well, it's not just out of the box. I mean, one of the clear things was that Demis from DeepMind talked about, you know, they assembled a set of AI tools in a particular way, and this is what the community is now trying to tease out. But Demis said he didn't think this was the only way of doing it, and that there may be, that, you know, they tried lots of different strategies in terms of building their network to capture all the information and, you know, make the problem trainable. And, you know, that's the implication. And in some ways, there is a slight element of it not quite being solved, because the input is not just the sequence of the protein, it's the sequence plus evolutionary related sequences. So you feed in a multiple sequence alignment. Now, it's clear that they don't need that much information from that, because they solved some structures where they had very few evolution-related sequences. But that is cheating in some way. It's pulling in information that the cell itself doesn't have access to. So, you know, the sequence in a cell doesn't go looking at the evolutionary picture of all biology to work out how to fold. It does it by itself. Yeah. So there's a little level of advance that's needed to really completely say, I just take the sequence and I fold it up. And that's actually important from the point of view of variant interpretation, because, you know, I want to know which variants are actually going to mess up the folding process. We don't really know how many of those are. Probably most of the variants that have disease effects do that because of the interactions between multiple molecules. But some of them probably mess up folding in some way. And of course, we know some diseases, you know, the Alzheimer's, dementia, they're linked to misfolded proteins in the brain. And there's a whole range of chaperones. That's something else I worked on a long time ago. This idea that there are proteins that help with folding and help with misfolded proteins and are important parts of the cleanup process in the cell, particularly when you get excess heat, for example. And so proteins are only, they're really marginally stable. So there's that. They have to be like that, otherwise you couldn't ever pull them apart. But that's a potential problem as well for the cell. You know, if you've got a misfolded state, you've got to deal with that as well.
Understood. And let's take a step back for a second. And with all of these advances, they're relying to some extent on this foundational advance of having mapped human DNA, the human genome, which to some extent we are almost taking for granted in this conversation. But that also was once upon a time a fundamentally unsolved problem. And you were a part of the team that solved that problem as well. Just take us back to that for a second. Paint a picture for us, maybe in the sort of early to mid 90s. How were we thinking about mapping the human genome, and how did it actually get done?
So I was at the MRC doing my protein, building protein structural databases actually at that time. And protein, you know, the sequence of genomes had been progressing from viruses to bigger and bigger viruses. And then in 1995, the first three living organisms were sequenced, actually by Craig Venter. And that was very impressive. And we did some work around saying, well, we've got these bacteria now, and we can look at the full protein set, because bacteria are much easier to process and to get the full sequence of all the proteins out of them. And that was the time that Sanger was really getting going, Sanger Institute. And so I was in a fellowship. I was looking for a group leader position, and I went for interview at Sanger. And I was intending to continue structural biology. And they said, well, you know, that's fine, but maybe you'd like a slightly more senior position, and it would just involve looking after the analysis of the human genome, and it won't take up any of your time, was the quote. And of course, I never did structural biology again after that. That's in 97. And that was, of course, the big scale-up time, where at that time we hadn't even sequenced 1% of the human genome. But the technology changed a bit. I mean, that's always been the driver, actually, of this technology improvements. When I was doing a PhD, even sequencing a short sequence of DNA was a major, major undertaking, you know, running a single experiment, to having machines that would do this on a production basis. But it still took thousands of people around the world to do this draft sequence for 2000. It really was a factory at Sanger, you know, with hundreds of machines and operators and people working. You know, there was a full shift system of people loading these gels, making gels and loading machines 24 hours a day, 24/7. To do this draft sequence. And then in many ways, when we did the first draft sequence, it was so expensive that we didn't actually think we'd be able to do that many more genomes. You know, we do it a mouse, try to do the zebrafish, various other key organisms were done, but nobody was talking about we're going to sequence lots and lots of individuals of any species at all. It was really a question, well, you know, can we justify getting the sequence of the chicken, for example, or the cow? You know, is anybody going to stump up the money to do that? And then there was this fundamental change in around, I guess, 2000, you know, mid-2000s, where this new technology came around. You know, in fact, the development of sequencing technologies has pretty much been in the UK. The first ones, Nobel Prizes from Sanger, right at the start. This new parallelized next generation sequencing came out of Solexa, developed in Cambridge. They were bought by Illumina, American company, and that changed the whole picture. So basically, the price dropped a millionfold. You went from thousands of people around the world sequencing to get a single human genome to you can do it in 27 hours on one machine. And that's what's, of course, opened up the possibility of sequencing people in the health service, individuals, their entire genome, and interpreting that, enabled by this next generation sequencing. Of course, the sequencing revolution is not finished. There's another technology, which is also from the UK, Nanopore out at Oxford, a technology where you don't chop the genome into fragments, which then are very hard to put together again, and particularly when it's very repetitive, you sequence single chains directly. But there are limitations to that right now in terms of accuracy. So sequencing technology has driven this. It's driven big data biology because the cheaper it is, the more people want to sequence. You go from, can I have the whole human genome, just one human genome, to can I get the human genome out of a single cell, or all of the RNAs in the single cell, which you can do now, single cell sequencing, so that you can investigate actual processes going on by collecting all the data, all the sequence data about them. That's transformative in terms of, you know, collecting additional data to try and understand how cells are functioning.
Wow. It's extraordinary how these kind of transformational technologies, like, I guess, Moore's Law for computer chips and next generation sequencing for reading DNA, just suddenly make something mainstream that, as you say, was previously an almost kind of Bayeux tapestry kind of labor of love of thousands of people in rows. Yeah, things are moving fast. Tim, any final thoughts before we drop?
I think that just that this, you know, this is it's a strange transformation that's happened, I guess, during my lifetime. Biology, as I said, I didn't do it at school because I thought it was, you know, boring and sort of not very digital, and it's become big data very much as a result of this transformation of the ability to collect information. It's the information that's the key thing. It's, you know, it's just data, and it's just a question of how easy it is to collect. The transformation in sequencing, you know, that price drop of, you know, a millionfold, that's far greater than Moore's Law. It's, you know, way in excess. It's probably the technology that has changed in, you know, dimensionality more than any other technology I think that anybody can think of. It's the thing to quote now instead of Moore's Law. We're just on this big data trajectory where we're competing with any other science, you know, any of the physical sciences that used to be around big data.
And when we see those kind of that growth in data and that reduction in compute, we know that weird and wonderful things start happening. So I figure we have a fair amount of that to look forward to in this field over the coming years.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, it's been clear from the protein folding problem, you know, why did it take so long? Some of it is about the amount of data you had. You know, we didn't have very many structures at the beginning. And even when Cas started, there weren't that many structures. And so there wasn't that much to learn from for things like neural networks, but any other types of algorithms that were being used. And, you know, that has been the input to a lot of these things for training a very large number of true examples from the result of the work of all these crystallographers. You know, I've seen this in various fields where, you know, it doesn't work today, but come back when there's 10 times more data and suddenly there's enough data to parameterize things and make some progress.
Well, Tim, it's exciting times to be alive, exciting times to be in this field. Thank you so much for taking the time, and all of the best for the next chapter of endeavors.
Thanks very much.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to The G-Word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G-Word.